for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama announces initiatives to curb the recruitment of extremists. Some Republicans back away from a showdown over funding the Department of Homeland Security, and donations to the Clinton Foundation raise ethical questions as Hillary Clinton ramps up an expected 2016 presidential run. Joining me for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Ron Elving of NPR, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and Manu Raju of Politico. And throughout the hour, we will be live streaming the Friday News Roundup. You can watch the program as well as listen. You can join the program by calling us at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And to see the show video streaming, go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hi, Dan.
Hey.
Good to see you all. Ron Elving, the president, laid out his approach to attack extremism this week at a White House summit on countering terrorism. What does he have in mind?
The president wants the United States to lead an international coalition of people who are attacking not only ISIS, but all forms of extremism, whether they're linked to religion or linked to something else. And this, of course, immediately got him into a tremendous amount of controversy because so many people feel that we should be calling this, quote, what it is, Islamic terrorism or Islamic radicalism. This is a struggle that's been going on for as long as we have been in the Middle East. Do we talk about the people that we're working against, or do we talk about their belief system? And George W. Bush had very much the same wrestling match with the language over this, and sometimes would just go through a catalog of terms that people had used, Islamofascism and all kinds of different terms, to try to villainize a particular streak of people's belief system without villainizing all of Islam. And this, of course, is a particularly difficult thing for this particular president to do because of his background, which is different from most Americans. He has had, if you will, a brush with Islam in his own childhood. And his middle name is Hussein. His name is an Islamic name. And people just have a hard time seeing him in the same terms as they would any other American leader, certainly George W. Bush, talking about the exact same things in much the same terms.
Karen.
Which led us to the really, I think, the unseemly scene of the week, which was Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, christened America's mayor after 9/11, standing up at a Republican fundraiser and actually declaring that the president of the United States doesn't love America. So again, it took us, you know, I think, into places where that, you know, there's a lot of raw emotion here, a lot of irrationality here as well. And the next day, the New York Post ran as its cover a picture of President Obama blindfolded, saying, "I just don't see it."
Yeah, you know, the White House will say that it's not using this label of Islamic extremism because they believe that it plays into the hands of terrorists who want to say that the West is at war with Islam. Of course, the concern with that is that by not clearly identifying who your enemy is, who exactly is the United States fighting? Because so much about war is about public relations, is about selling the world and the country about your enemy and really generating a lot of antipathy towards the person you're going after. And that's one of the issues that the White House has struggled with, is defining exactly who the United States is at war with.
But now let me take this to another point. Doesn't or don't Rudy Giuliani's comments sort of feed into their hatred of the United States and particularly the policies of President Obama, Karen?
I think that in particular, this was probably more about domestic politics.
Of course, but 2016, but nevertheless.
But what I think, you know, some of the president's other comments, and I don't want to tiptoe into the second hour here, but he was also talking about dealing with some of the conditions that create the economic stresses, the civil liberties stresses that sort of create this group of kind of disenfranchised people who would feel, and alienated people would be the better word, that who would feel the desire to, the attraction to join some sort of movement like ISIS.
And there are now three young women missing from the UK, suspected of having traveled through Turkey into Syria, Ron.
There are going to be more and more cases of people who have disappeared from the West and are turning up in this part of the world. There is a, hard to understand for Americans, but there is a strong appeal to a certain kind of disaffected young person who has felt oppressed in the West. Even though we think of the West as the land of freedom, they, for their own reasons and for their own experiences, have felt it the opposite. And they are attracted to the idea of an ideology that is going to free them from that sense of second-classness, third-classness, rejectionism, and that, in a sense, empowers them with exactly what made them feel inferior before.
Interesting, Manu, that the Pentagon kept a low profile at that summit.
Yeah, and so did the FBI. The FBI director, James Comey, did not show up at this summit as well. But you did have some other interesting people who showed up. The Russian intelligence official showed up at that. And of course, Russia and the United States have had frosty ties over the years. And the White House wanted to show that this was something that had broad the support of this campaign against ISIS, had broad international backing. But there was a question internally and domestically about who exactly is in charge over this counterterrorism strategy, given that there was no FBI presence from the top official. And, of course, the Pentagon has kept a low profile as well.
So how will the White House language perhaps change over the coming months?
The president does need to address the fact that while he's speaking to an international audience and he does want to de-emphasize the, if you will, demonization of all things Islamic, and that's, by the way, gotten a fair amount of positive response from people we are trying to reach, especially Sunni that we're trying to reach in that region. So there is a reason for him doing it, and that has had some degree of payoff. But he has to deal with the backlash in the United States, because otherwise, if he doesn't keep the American people behind him, if he doesn't keep the American military establishment, security establishment firmly behind him, then he isn't really the president of the United States, leveraging all the assets that the White House should normally have at its command. So he does have to deal with that. He has to find another linguistic path, as George W. Bush eventually did, largely by just coming up with other terms to use entirely.
And this is an argument, by the way, being made not just by the president's opposition. It is also being made by some of his allies who sense that, you know, there is, while these, you know, these awful things that we are seeing in the news almost every day don't represent the tenets of Islam, they are nonetheless being done in the name of Islam.
And the president's going to really have to do a pretty aggressive sales job on Capitol Hill in order to get his authorization for use of military force through the Congress in his campaign against ISIS. There's concerns both from the left and the right over the way that this is structured. People on the left do not think that the president should get as much authority as he wants to wage war, and people on the right want to really give him more authority to wage war. So the president, in order to sell this, not only will he have to clarify his language, he'll have to make a pretty aggressive effort, both publicly and behind closed doors on the Hill.
Manu Raju, he's senior congressional reporter with Politico. Let's move on to what's happening with these West Coast ports. Karen, White House officials have apparently given both sides a deadline of today. Labor Secretary Perez has been out there always trying to negotiate an agreement between the two sides. What's going to happen?
Well, you're right. Secretary Perez was out there on Tuesday. There's been kind of a news blackout in terms of what's been going on inside the room that's been imposed in part by the mediator. Basically, what happened here is that the contract governing the unions and the shipping in ports, and we're talking about 29 ports here that go from San Diego to Billingham, Washington, expired last summer. And since then, there has been very much of a slowdown of work there. And each side is blaming the other. The union is blaming the shipping companies, saying that they are just slowing things down to increase their leverage on the unions. The shipping companies are saying that they are now seeing just a huge increase in the volume of goods coming in and out of West Coast ports, and that as a result, there's some infrastructure changes. They need new technologies. They need, you know, there are these just absolutely mammoth ships coming in, and they have to come up with new ways of dealing with that.
Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post. When we come back, we'll talk about how the White House might react if and when this issue comes back to Washington. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college and career and supporting innovation that can improve public schools at gatesfoundation.org. From the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
And welcome back. We've just learned from Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar at the LA Times that the Obama administration says it sent about 800,000 healthcare.gov customers the wrong tax information. Officials are asking those consumers to delay filing their 2014 taxes. Now, for those who've already filed, that's going to be a little bit of a problem, I would think. Glitches continue, don't they, Ron?
You know, it says in the story, Diane, that about 50,000 or so who have already filed may have to resubmit their returns. And it also means that there'll probably be some people, quite a few more people, perhaps a million people, may wait a little longer to get their tax refunds this year. That's going to obviously make people unhappy. This is probably going to be seen as one more reason on the part of all those who oppose Obamacare that it was never a good idea for the government to get involved in this way. But on the other hand, it's probably somewhat inevitable that a certain amount of information is going to be incorrectly delivered if, in fact, this is the limit of the error, and if, in fact, it can be corrected and people wait a little longer and people are told they have to delay to file their returns. Probably there are some of us who don't need any further encouragement to delay filing our returns. So in the end, this could be one more of the many glitches that have been thus far surmounted in going forward, there are much bigger hurdles out there waiting for the Affordable Care Act.
Of course, we're going to get to those. Go ahead,
But this
Karen.
Happens at a very sensitive moment, because this is the moment at which one of the controversial aspects of the law kicks in, which is that people who can afford health insurance and choose not to buy it have to pay a penalty with their tax returns. And this is an aspect of the law that I think a lot of people are not aware of. And it's going to come as a kind of bad surprise to them as they file their return. So a number of particularly Democrats in Congress have been asking anyway for some sort of, you know, reprieve for these people, a second chance to go ahead and buy health insurance if they don't have it. And this is really exactly what they didn't need to happen at this point.
Yeah, especially since this has been the campaign that the administration has been launching in recent weeks has been how successful the enrollment period has been. There's 11.4 million people who have signed up, and the fact that this information is now out there, that they've given this wrong information, is only going to feed the distrust and the detractors of this law. My only surprise is that this came out on a Friday morning instead of Friday afternoon.
Yeah. Late Friday afternoon.
Right.
I want to go back to this West Coast ports issue, because is there a chance the president might invoke Taft-Hartley?
You know, we haven't talked about Taft-Hartley in a very
long time.
I mean, this is really a throwback. It's almost got a certain nostalgic quality to it. The president has special authority under that act back from the late 1940s that allows him, when the national security or the national interest demands, to step in and temporarily impose some sort of stoppage on, well, excuse me, an interruption of the stoppage if
and
there
it's
is.
It's not a stoppage. It's a slowdown.
That's right.
And
right
we
now,
ought
it's
to
a
be
slowdown.
Careful.
Right
yeah.
now, it's a slowdown.
Right.
But there is talk of a lockout.
Right.
And the two parties appear to be very far apart. So we don't know. Of course, negotiations oftentimes look like they're hopeless. It's always darkest just before the dawn. And it could result in some sort of an agreement coming out in just the next couple of days. And as we have said, the Secretary of Labor is out there, or has been out there, and is negotiating this. And, you know, the Taft-Hartley threat, we haven't seen this in a very long time. It used to be imposed on things like steel strikes and railroad strikes in particular. But this has a lot in common with the old railroad strike strategy, which was you basically hit a stoppage point, you hit a sphincter, if you will, in the entire system. You hit a choke point, and certainly the West Coast ports, considering how important our Asian trade is now, are a key choke point for
now,
this economy as a whole.
It's my understanding, after we did this program on this issue yesterday, that in fact the disagreement comes down to arbitration. And the four arbiters have, in effect, a lifetime contract. And the union, the labor union, longshoremen's union, wants that typically to come back to 4 to 6 years. They have an especial problem with one arbiter.
Yeah, and that's been the issue all along. I mean, it's not so much about the wages and the contracts.
Right, which have been settled.
Right,
for a
right.
While.
It's all about the arbitration right now. But, you know, as Karen alluded to earlier, it's hard to know exactly where they are in that dispute right now. And I think it's going to be a big risk for the Obama administration to invoke Taft-Hartley, given how close they are to the labor unions and how they're going to have to take on the labor unions in a couple of months when they try to push through a trade deal that most in the labor world does not like, the Trade Promotion Authority and also this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. So this is not a slam dunk. This is not an easy thing for the president to do, and I think they're going to tread pretty carefully.
All right. Let's talk about the judge's action on immigration. You had a Texas judge ruling that really has imperiled one of the president's most important actions. Karen, do you want to speak to it?
The judge used a relatively narrow set of grounds for this to say basically that the president had not, you know, put this expansion, this program up for public comment the way you normally do for regulatory things. Thus far, the White House and the Justice Department is indicating that it is not likely to ask for an emergency stay. So the bottom line is that this is going to put off the protection from deportation to the parents of children who are born here legally and others who were covered under the president's order for months, possibly even longer.
So why isn't the president asking for a stay on the judge's ruling?
Well, they're definitely going to appeal it to the Fifth Circuit, but I think a stay on the ruling could further complicate things. I think that's what they're deliberating right now. If, let's say, the judge were to side with the administration's argument, then they would presumably begin taking applications and start moving forward in this process. But if the higher courts, the appeals courts, rule a different way and actually strike down what the president's doing, then they'll throw the whole thing into flux. So I think that's been part of their calculation, and it's all playing out too in the middle of this very contentious debate on Capitol Hill about whether or not to try to block the president's executive actions and tie that to a must-pass Homeland Security funding bill that needs to pass Congress by the end of next week.
Now, tell me about Republicans kind of switching sides here as to whether to use this as a lever to shut down the government and then to back away from that.
It's slightly confusing because on the one hand, certainly the Republicans want to embrace this decision from the one district court judge down in Brownsville, Texas, and say, see, the law is on our side. The Constitution is on our side. Now, as Karen pointed out, we're really just talking about the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. It's a very narrow decision. It's funny that this is coming back same as the Taft-Hartley era. That was also a Republican-dominated Congress and a feisty Democratic president in Harry Truman. And in this particular instance, the judge is saying you've got to take more time. You've got to give the states more time to comply and so on. But the Republicans are seizing on this as a kind of blanket approval of their overall position with regard to these immigration executive actions. So the president has this opportunity, if you will, to cast all of this in a slightly different light and take a little bit of time. And I think that's probably part of the reason they're not reaching for the stay. The Republicans have a wonderful opportunity, it seems to me, that they could suddenly declare victory and say, well, we don't need to burden the Department of Homeland Security appropriation with this any longer. Now we have the courts on our side, the laws on our side. We're going to prevail in the courts. So let's just go ahead and have a clean bill on the Department of Homeland Security funding, go past this little obstacle that we set up for ourselves, and we'll come back and we'll prevail in the courts. And if we don't, then we'll revisit it later on.
But then didn't Marco Rubio say exactly that? No need to burden this with the Homeland Security funding. And then the next day, step back.
He didn't. Marco Rubio tends to say a lot. He talks very quickly. I looked at the transcript of his remarks. He did not call for a clean spending bill. He said we shouldn't shut down the government. That's not the same thing as we shouldn't use this to attack the immigration policy. You know, this is the way that the Republicans are going to argue this. They're not saying they're the ones shutting down the Department of Homeland Security. They're going to say Democrats are by blocking this bill from coming forward in the Senate.
Because that's what the polling has already indicated, that Republicans would be charged with shutting down the government.
Well, they're the ones who left out the Department of Homeland Security when they funded the rest of the government all the way through the fiscal year. And also because we have a body within the Republican Party that keeps saying, this is our opportunity, we should shut it down, we should force the president's hand. And that group is quite vocal. And thus far, they seem to be prevailing because at least in public, the leaders, Mitch McConnell in the Senate, John Boehner in the House, have been saying that they're not going to take this opportunity to back off on their confrontation with the president.
But writ large, this is a moment of high peril for the Republicans because they have just been given the steering wheel on Capitol Hill. They have taken over both houses of Congress. And, you know, if one of the first things that happens after this is that a, you know, major government agency that is responsible for protecting us from an, you know, an increasingly dangerous world has to shut down a lot of its operations, this is really not a great signal to be sending to the country about Republican governance.
And Boehner and McConnell are just in a box right now because Boehner cannot get the clean Homeland Security bill through the House right now. He does not have the votes for that. And the Republican caucus would revolt if he tried to move that. So that's why he said the Senate needs to pass a bill. But the problem is that the bill that the House passed cannot clear a Democratic filibuster. So the Senate is in a box, too. And McConnell knows that he's not going to pass a clean bill if it's not going to pass the House. The question is, can they do something? And the betting is that there probably will be some sort of short-term stopgap resolution to keep the agency afloat for 2 months. But even that would provoke a backlash from folks on the right who say, look, we just won a big court ruling that went after the president's immigration action. We need to solidify this into law right now. There's no clear way out right now.
How long might it be before we get a Fifth Circuit appeal ruling?
Well, it's not going to be overnight. It's going to be weeks, months, and then it's going to be appealed to the Supreme Court in all likelihood. And that means we're probably into the next session of the Supreme Court, which doesn't begin until October. So the final resolution on this particular challenge to this law is probably, or not law, rather, but executive action, is probably down the road quite a piece. So that's why it would appear that the Republicans would be missing an opportunity here to get out of the box that they're in and proceed more or less to satisfy the broadest spectrum of their constituencies by stepping back from this confrontation and accepting this judge's offer as a gift.
But 2 months of extending funding for Homeland Security is not going to be enough.
No, but then at the end of those 2 months, you come back and you say, well, okay, things are proceeding well in the court system, so let's now fill out the rest of the fiscal year and take it up to September 30th.
And that's the concern about for the Republicans. I mean, they have wanted to come forward with a big, proactive agenda, really, you know, begin to change the debate in Washington. But if they do another short-term extension, they're going to keep fighting last year's debates and keep being drawn into these fiscal crises.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Manu, the White House has announced a new director of the Secret Service, someone that the Department of Homeland Security did not necessarily recommend because he is not an outsider.
Yeah, there was. This was, of course, after a number of controversies over the years involving the Secret Service. Most notably, last fall, when a man jumped the White House fence, he had a knife. He got into the residence before people, the Secret Service, tackled him. Eventually, that led to the resignation of Julia Pearson, Joseph Clancy, a 27-year veteran of the Secret Service, became the interim director, and the White House announced this week that Clancy would become the permanent director. Now, after Pearson resigned, Jay Johnson, the Homeland Security Secretary, convened a panel of experts to figure out how to clean up the Secret Service, and they said that the best way to do that would be to name someone who, an outsider, someone who could shake things up from the inside. But, you know, this is an agency over its 150-year history that has never had someone who has not been an agent running the Secret Service. And I think in the end, both Jay Johnson and the president believed that Joe Clancy, who does have some experience in the private sector, he worked at Comcast for some time, could bring his both inside and outside perspective to shake things up.
That's right. And the Comcast time was quite recent. I mean, he did that after all the agencies hit this tough patch, and he seemed to have exited and become more of a private sector person. And he's been out just long enough to say, I am sort of an outsider. But, of course, he really is part of,
sure,
I won't say the problem necessarily, but if the problem is a good old boy network, well, Joseph Clancy is certainly part of the good old boy network.
He actually covered Clinton and Bush.
His face would be familiar to most Americans because they've seen him in so many pictures with the president.
Right. He has two things going for him. One is apparently an enormous reservoir of personal trust by the president and first lady. And number two, he's apparently made a fairly good impression on Capitol Hill. So those things are operating in his favor.
Yeah, and he also demoted four senior-level Secret Service agents over the last, I think in the last month or so, who to show that he was taking the concern seriously and he was trying to shake up the agency. So that may have alleviated some criticism.
What
as
kind
well.
Of shakeup are we likely to see in terms of behavior, attitude, so on?
You know, part of this, and I think from the aspect of the agency, their perspective is that their budget has been such that they have been stretched in such a way that they don't have training for agents. They have very few minutes of training, in fact, rather than hours of training in an average year. They don't stay current with new technology. There are a lot of things that they want to do, but they can't because they have so many missions. They're short-staffed, in their view, and that leads to a lot of the strains that have led to a lot of these problems. Now, Clancy's intimately familiar with all of that, both from an administrative point of view and from the agent's point of view on the ground level.
Ron Halving of NPR. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about Jeb Bush, his foreign policy speech. We'll talk about Hillary Clinton's massive fundraising effort and more.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Fighting in Ukraine continues despite a ceasefire. European officials meet to negotiate a loan extension for Greece. And President Obama calls for a united global front to combat terrorism. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We've got lots more to talk about, but let's open the phones, welcome our guests who are out there listening and in some cases watching the program. And if you're not and you'd like to, go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. Let's go to Michael in Brandon, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi,
Diane. Hi there.
It's an absolute pleasure. You have the best show on the radio or TV.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome. I'm calling you. I'm a merchant mariner, and I'm a unionized member of MEBA. And I wanted to bring some attention. Back in 2001, under President Bush, a similar situation occurred. It was right around the holiday season, and the Taft-Hartley Act was invoked. Now, what people might want to, or maybe they forgot or they don't know, what was unusual about that was the workers did not strike. What happened was the ship owners basically locked them out. And by locking out the workers, of course, work stoppage occurred. And that was the first time, I believe, that it was used in a reverse way. So I just want people to be aware of that, because a lot of people have the misconception that, well, okay, the dock workers, they're striking, they're causing the problem. It needs to be looked at closely to see what is actually really happening.
I totally agree with you, Manu.
Yeah, I think the Taft-Hartley Act gives the president pretty broad authority if there's a lockout or if workers are striking in order to appoint a board of inquiry into this, as well as petition the federal courts to force industry and labor to work to prevent anything from threatening national safety. And that's clearly what Bush did in 2002, which, as the caller rightly points out, was the last time this was invoked.
All right. To Tom in Rockford, Illinois, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I'm calling from the heartland in America, and I'm an angry person. I'm getting very tired of the politicking that's going on in the state and federal level. For example, the bickering over whether or not Homeland Security will be funded, attaching, cutting Obama's deportation policies. On the state level, I'm getting tired of hearing about cuts to Medicaid, funding for public transportation, 31% cuts to higher education. I mean, I'm tired of the hypocrisy on the state and national level. When are these guys going to stop working on their agendas and working on helping Americans?
I think there are a lot of people out there who probably would agree with Tom's assessment, Karen.
And I think the answer to that is when voters start punishing politicians for behaving this way. But
absolutely,
right now, as it is, the two sides are reinforced by their strongly ideological bases when they do this.
All right, let's talk about Jeb Bush's foreign policy address, the first he has made since indicating he may possibly run in 2016. How'd he do, Manu?
Well, he tried to create a distinction between himself and his father and his brother. He said, "I'm my own man," which was the headline-grabbing quote. In addition, he said the mistakes were made in Iraq. But other than that, he sounded a lot like his brother. I mean, his foreign policy, he talked about how he thought the NSA surveillance program was a legitimately good program. He called for higher defense budgets. He said that the Iraq troop surge that his president, that his brother called for was one of the most politically courageous moves. This was Jeb's first foray into foreign policy to really detail his thinking and show what he is like. And I think he ended up sounding a lot like his hawkish brother and like a lot of the hawks in the Republican Party.
But even as he gave this speech in Chicago that was very closely watched, he also released a list of more than 20 names of people who would be his sort of brain trust on foreign policy. And it included, it basically felt like he was checking the box of every strain of foreign policy thought in the mainstream Republican Party. It had some relative moderates, like former Secretaries of State George Shultz and James Baker, but it also had Paul Wolfowitz, who was an architect of the Iraq War. What was also interesting is who was missing from that list, and the chief person being Condoleezza Rice, who is probably as close to the Bush family as any leading person.
So how do you account for that?
Well, there are a couple of things going on here. One is that she is now running a 501c3 organization, so she has to stay out of politics. But I also think that that was at least symbolically an effort to, again, put this little bit of distance between himself and his brother's policies. But the fact is, as we reported, as other people reported, he has been talking to Condoleezza Rice informally.
Interesting.
The great majority of the people that he cited as his foreign policy advisors were advisors to his father or his brother, and among those, the great majority, to his brother. And that includes people such as Paul Wolfowitz, who was a key defense undersecretary, deputy secretary of the Department of Defense, and largely the architect of the overall strategy of what we were doing in Iraq, later at the World Bank. These are names that are going to resonate with many people in the Washington policy community and ought to resonate with voters when they look back on what transpired in the 8 years of the George W. Bush presidency. Also in this speech, there were just moments of a lack of confidence, it seemed. He had a lot of criticism for not seeming to have been really familiar with this kind of material. Maybe it was a little early to come out with a foreign policy speech because he's really been, throughout his career, focused more on domestic issues. That's what he's known for as a governor of Florida. And, you know, there were errors, you know, referring to 200,000 ISIS fighters. And actually, the staff came out later and said he meant to say 20,000.
Yeah. But one more thing that was going on here was an effort, I think, to make it impossible for both in his rhetoric and in the people he's supposedly surrounding himself with, to make it impossible for any other Republican candidate to get to his right on foreign policy, because he's already got this problem on domestic issues like Common Core, where he's considered too much of a moderate for much of the Republican base, on immigration. So he's sort of trying to inoculate himself on foreign policy.
And I think we're seeing also how national security and foreign policy is really going to dominate the Republican presidential race more so than in the last cycle for certain, and potentially as much as in previous election cycles after 9/11. You're already seeing this national security debate played out. I talked to Marco Rubio about Jeb Bush's speech, and he said that Rubio himself is trying to pitch himself as the foreign policy expert in this race. He sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said about Jeb Bush, well, I think he's very, very capable of learning about foreign policy.
Damning with a faint phrase.
Yes, that would be that.
From his former political protege.
<That's> right.
All right, so-called. And Karen, we learned this week that the Clinton Foundation has raised close to $2 billion since its 2001 creation. There are concerns about the global network overlapping Hillary's political base.
That's right. First of all, they deserve some credit here for being very transparent, much more so about who's giving money. But there are two big concerns, I think, here. One are, the number of people, foreign interests, foreign governments even, who would be prohibited from giving money to a Hillary Clinton political campaign, but can give money to this charitable thing. It's in part, people will argue, an effort to curry favor with the Clintons. The second big issue, I think, and it's likely to be a big issue with the liberal base, people who support people like Elizabeth Warren, the single biggest financial sector contributing to the Clinton Foundation is Wall Street. And as a result, I think, you can argue, and people will, that this is, again, the banking industry and Wall Street sort of currying favor with them.
And speaking of Elizabeth Warren, Mrs. Clinton met with her.
Yes.
Recently.
Yes, back in December, they sat down, had a chat. One would have loved to have been a fly on the wall or serve them tea or whatever it would have taken to hear what they were talking about. I suspect that presidential politics entered into the conversation. And my general impression is that Elizabeth Warren has made a broad judgment here about the 2016 race, and that she was facing a decision very much like a young senator at a similar point in his career named Barack Obama had to make 8 years ago in deciding whether or not to take on a candidate who was considered a juggernaut at that time, that she was to be the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. But Barack Obama decided maybe she wasn't that invulnerable, and that maybe it was a good time for him to run, and that maybe it was the best time for him to run, and he went ahead and ran. That was the decision he made 8 years ago, and he announced this month, 8 years ago. So Elizabeth Warren is looking at a very similar situation in general, but the position that Hillary Clinton is in today is a great deal stronger than she was in 8 years ago. She is a much wiser candidate. She has a much tighter grip on the imagination of the Democratic Party than she did 8 years ago. There isn't nearly the field against her that there was, and that helped Barack Obama 8 years ago. And Elizabeth Warren does not see herself as a candidate quite like Barack Obama. She has more time. She perhaps has a little more patience. And she sees a great opportunity for herself in politics over the next several years without running for
president. Yeah, and the context of this meeting was that Hillary is creating this economic platform. She's meeting with a bunch of advisors, politicians, people who represent different parts of the Democratic Party. And clearly, Elizabeth Warren speaks to that populist progressive wing that rails against Wall Street and the big institutions. And this was an effort to sort of inoculate her from the criticism that she did not take enough feedback from that wing of the party. And it's just also, it's a shrewd move by Hillary, too. I think that what politicians do when they see potential threats is they befriend those threats. They try to bring them into their inner circle, into their wing. And I think that Hillary views Warren as someone who would be much more helpful as an ally than an enemy.
Keep your enemies very close.
That's right. That's what Godfather said.
And indeed, Elizabeth Warren has said repeatedly that she would not be a candidate for the 2016 presidential run. Oregon has a brand new governor, Manu, to replace Democrat John Kitzhaber, who stepped down amid corruption charges involving, apparently, his fiancé.
Yeah, it was a really stunning fall from grace for the governor. I mean, this is a four-term governor, someone who has served longer than any governor in Oregon history. Suddenly to fall in light of the investigation that's ongoing between him and his fiancé, Sylvia Hayes, who has an environmental consulting business. And the question was raised about whether she used that business in order to personally enrich herself through government contracts and other things that the governor was doing. And it just became, you know, kind of a drip, drip, drip of bad information that continually came out, not just about these potential corruption challenges, but also about her personal life, as well as how she apparently married an Ethiopian immigrant simply to help him get a permanent residency. All of that seemed to lead to his downfall.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Karen, you want to add?
Well, I just want to, because I know a lot of your listeners are really interested in media issues. This is also a story that speaks to the importance of having a robust local press, a local media in your town, because basically, all of this goes down to one reporter's digging. And I will apologize if I mispronounce his name. Nigel Jacquess works for an alternative newspaper and actually started noticing things like parking tickets on her part. And one thing led to another, and the other local media jumped in. Oregon being a place that's sort of far away from the New York-Washington axis media hub. And so I think we ought to give some credit here to dogged local journalism.
I'm glad you did that, Karen.
Microjournalism leading to macro results, starting from very small things and sticking with it and being determined about it. This was beginning to be noticed by people last fall. Kitzhaber had a little more trouble getting reelected than people expected him to have, and it just didn't go away after the election.
And what do we know about the incoming governor, Kate Brown?
This is an interesting story, in part because some of the states in the West do not have lieutenant governors. This is a case where they don't have a lieutenant governor, and she was the Secretary of State. When people vote for Secretary of State, they very rarely think they're voting for the person who is going to be the next governor. So not that much was known about her, and she is immediately coming out and talking about how much transparency there is going to be, how much they're going to clean up the operations of the government so that such things as panels recommending a particular contractor receive a government contract from the state, have that recommendation honored rather than having it ignored, as happened with the case of Sylvia Hayes, when she was deemed not qualified and the last among the people seeking the contract, she still won it. That's the kind of thing that should never happen. That's the kind of thing that any government should be on the lookout for. And it's usually journalism, though, that finds it and brings it to public light.
All right. So two more quick things. Walmart has announced a wage increase for a 500,000 employees. How big a deal, Ron?
It's a big deal for people who work for Walmart, for one thing, obviously. Now, of course, it's not just a simple matter because their part-time workers are paid at one kind of rate.
Right.
And their full-time workers make more per hour. And then there are different positions, so the averages are all over the place. But they are saying that no one will make less than $9 as of April and that no one will make less than $10 next year.
Right.
And those are significant increases at a time when people are talking a lot about minimum wage, when states are raising the minimum wage, when the federal government has a proposed increase in its federal minimum wage, and also at a time when the unemployment rate has fallen below 6%. We're down almost something like 5 points from the peak several years ago, 5 years ago. So that's a huge change, and one would expect that wages would begin to increase in reaction to that as labor becomes more valued and more scarce.
And I do recall when Walmart wanted to come here to Washington, the mayor said, not unless you pay your employees, what was it, $12?
Right.
Now, I recall. Now, last thing, Academy Awards. What are you rooting for in picture?
Boyhood.
Boyhood.
American Sniper.
And I am rooting for The Theory of Everything. And I'm also going to wish all of you a great weekend. Enjoy yourselves. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.